Welcome to the Hallie Kasserjane Show, talk radio for fine minds. And now your host for the hour, Hallie Kasserjane.
And hi, my friends, and welcome to the Hallie Kasserjane Show, coming to you today from Florida's gorgeous Treasure Coast. I'm your host, Hallie Kasserjane. As always, I'm so happy to have you here today on the Hallie Kasserjane Show, the real greatest generation, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and the Marquis de Lafayette. Our guest today, Nancy Hayward, Director of Educational Outreach at Mount Vernon. Susan R. Stein, the Richard Gildert Senior Curator and Vice President of Museum Programs at Monticello. And author Mark Leibson of the book Lafayette, Monticello. Mark, I'm going to screw that up. Here you go. But his great book, Lafayette, the Idealist General. We'll be back with my guest today on the Hallie Kasserjane Show, talk radio for fine minds, after this word from our sponsor, Treasure Coast Hospice.
Is someone you love living with frequent pain? Are they spending more time just sitting in a chair or lying in bed or going to the ER more often? Other than taking them to the doctor, you may not know what else to do. Treasure Coast Hospice can help in more ways than you may realize. Even if you don't think your loved one is ready for hospice care, their experts can evaluate your loved one's condition and direct you to the right resources in our community. Call Treasure Coast Hospice to learn more or visit tchospice.org.
Nancy Hayward currently serves as Director of Educational Outreach for Mount Vernon. With a background in history and museum education, she has been at Mount Vernon for 19 years. She is surely as knowledgeable as anyone on the subject of the first President of the United States, George Washington, and I am delighted to have Nancy with us on the show today. Welcome, Nancy Hayward. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Hallie. Thanks so much for including me in the program.
Oh, I'm just thrilled to have you here. That's one of my favorite places, and aren't you lucky to get to spend your days there? Nancy, George Washington, the father of our country, you know we titled the show The Real Greatest Generation, sort of a challenge to Tom Brokaw's claim that the World War II generation deserved that title. But the real greatest generation begins with George Washington, the first real American leader, doesn't it?
I would say, well, I'll certainly give a nod to our World War II generation, but I would have to agree that, you know, Washington is the root of our nation and all that comes after that. So I would certainly think that he deserves that title of being part of the first great generation.
Let's talk about Washington and his character. And I guess to understand him, we have to go back to his beginnings. Tell us somewhat, a little bit of his youth. Let's, you know, just give an overall.
Well, he's the oldest son of his father's second marriage. So, and that may not seem important, but when it comes time for inheriting, he doesn't get the large, wealthier properties. His older brother, Lawrence, becomes his mentor, and Lawrence actually inherits Mount Vernon. So Washington spends a great deal of his youth here at Mount Vernon with his older brother, who becomes the father figure for him. Lawrence is very well connected. He marries into the Fairfax family. So through that, Washington gets entree into sort of the upper echelons of Virginia society, and he becomes a very ambitious man. And, you know, one of the things I talk about with teachers and students is ambition in a very positive manner. I mean, I think sometimes today we think if somebody says, oh, they're ambitious, it's negative. Washington has very positive ambitions. He's driven to succeed. And I think we could all agree that he reaches that expectation.
To say the least. So let's talk about William Fairfax, because he did become Washington's mentor. And I think that's interesting in this respect. All three of the men that we're talking about today had mentors who helped catapult them to their greatness. But would you say that Washington's success was written on the wind, or that he created it with the help of his mentor, or D, all of the above? What?
A little bit of all of the above. You know, you just look at somebody like Washington who seems to be blessed with everything. But he worked very hard at everything that he achieved. And certainly his brother Lawrence, the Fairfax family, who took him on his first surveying trip when he was 16. And that launched his earliest career. So, and, you know, building blocks, you know, what does he get from being a surveyor? His going out into the wilderness, his familiarity with that leads to his diplomatic mission to the Ohio Valley. So there's certainly a thread that runs through this. But I think any one of us who really succeeds has somebody that's guiding and helping and advising us. And Washington was very lucky to have both Lawrence and William Fairfax advising him.
The anger at the Brits, let's jump ahead a little bit, the fight for the independence for which he so strongly fought. Was it as a warrior, as a moralist, both? Was it independence for which he fought or equity? It's kind of an interesting thing how that all came together and made him who he became. Talk to me about that a little bit.
Well, absolutely. And I think large part of it, and you'll see this thread throughout Washington's life, is economic. But Washington, at the First Continental Congress, their goal was not independence. It was, as I think you used the word, equity. They wanted acknowledgement. They wanted representation. It wasn't until later that you begin to see this talk of independence. But Washington writes a letter, because Fairfax remains a loyalist, and there's a wonderful letter that Washington writes to him saying that England has no more right to put their hand in his pocket then Washington has the right to put his hand in Fairfax's pocket. So he sees it as an economic issue. He sees the taxes without representation, which is sort of the battle cry, so to speak, is not a moral policy. And that gains his anger. And the fact that England doesn't seem to take them seriously, the House of Burgesses is shut down in Williamsburg. So there's a chain of events that takes place that leads Washington, along with his sort of compatriots at the time, to the concept that really independence is going to be necessary.
This thing about him, though, as the general, as the warrior, whatever. Now, that's something that's different, though, isn't it? I mean, he had talked to me about a little bit about him as in that role.
Well, he's in a very unique role. I mean, when he becomes commander-in-chief of the Continental Army, it's basically an army of one. You know, you have these militia groups, and it's Washington's task to band these together and to form this United States, or at that time, Continental Army.
Sure.
He has some military experience, and he's willing to serve. Many people will say, well, he showed up at the Second Continental Congress in his military uniform, so, you know, he's sort of in some ways pointing to himself. I don't know personally if that was his point to say, make me commander-in-chief, or if he was saying, I am ready to serve in whatever way that you need me, because that would be very typical of Washington's character.
But I like that. Yeah. And the reason I you heard me go, because where I was with the thought in my head at that point was that this guy is a born leader. And you almost get the feeling, you know, if you take into the equity issue, if you take into all the other things that we've just been talking about up until now, but then as commander-in-chief, you know, there's commander-in-chief the warrior, there's commander-in-chief as the leader. And I think where I'm going with it is I got the feeling anyway in all my research that he was so much a leader. It just came naturally to him.
I say absolutely. And I think he also has what, you know, today we would call that command presence. I mean, he certainly physically stands above most of the men of the 18th century. And then he has the determination and perseverance. And there are accounts not only from his officers, from soldiers in the field, from the French officers who met him, and they all remark upon this presence of Washington. He didn't fight from the back. Certainly at Princeton, you know, he drove his aides crazy when rode out in front of his troops to lead the charge. He had tremendous physical courage, and that is the type of attribute I think raises the admiration amongst the men that serve under you, and they believe in you, and they know that you will fight with them. And Washington had that in spades.
You could say he was our first politician. And it's interesting, as president, that he didn't even think he should be paid, right?
He didn't. He had served all 8 years as commander-in-chief without pay. He did file for reimbursement for his expenses, but he did not take a salary. And he thought he thought it was his duty to serve as president. And there's a great quote that Washington writes in early 1770s, I believe, where he says it's the duty of every man in the vigor of life to serve where needed. And Washington saw the presidency as his duty. So that idea, though, quite honestly, I believe it was John Adams who didn't like that idea. He felt that the president was a public servant and almost like the employee. So that meant that pay was involved. This sort of concept of doing without pay would sort of muddy the waters a bit. So he did have a salary as president of the United States.
Again, morality. Let's go back to morality. Were men of that time simply more morally circumspect than they are today? Or do you think that Washington was better than most even in his time?
Well, I'm very biased, Hallie. So I think that Washington, I believe he stands a bit above the men even of his time. It's hard to judge because part of me wants to say, oh, absolutely, you know, he's just better. There's nobody since then, now, that can measure up to George Washington in terms of character, the sense of duty, his moral obligations. But that's a pretty broad paint stroke for me to say. I think they were raised differently with the concept that it is their obligation, there is their moral duty to serve amongst certain classes, and that's another discussion that you get into. But Washington genuinely believed that.
Yeah, and I guess you could also get into the times, too, because there was something very real happening there that people could attach to in terms of, you know, freedom from, you know, oppression by the Brits at the time. All right, here's another one. Leadership. Let's go back there for a second, because he did take some gaffe in the early days of the campaign against the Brits, right? I mean, he wasn't his people kind of like weren't too thrilled with him. I think one point, wasn't there a time when they were going to try and usurp his authority? Yes.
Well, yeah, and I mean that wasn't a widespread, but certainly yes, it's called the Conway Cabal. But there were some behind the scenes maneuverings to remove Washington, and you know, this is a man as a general. And you know, historians still argue today whether he was a great tactician, whether he was a great general, a battlefield general. He lost more battles than he won. However, what really marks it, he never gave up. And that he has this absolute determination that we will win independence, and he does whatever it takes to make that happen. And not all of it is done, ironically, on the battlefield. But he adjusts his strategy, and he learns, and you know, and he hangs on.
I think that's my point. I think the thing that I saw there was that he always seemed to learn from his mistakes.
Absolutely.
And I think that has to do with great leadership. Those who don't learn or think they're above learning, I think, fail, you know, long term. He was a family man. I mean, he adored his mother and said he owed everything that he was to her. And I would like to talk about that and also his relationship to his wife. You told me that he had burned all the letters. That was something that I didn't know. Or she had
she
burned
did.
All
she
the
burned
letters.
The letters. Yeah.
Right.
Three have been
so,
found since then.
Yeah. So let's just talk about him as a family man. Family was utterly important to him.
Absolutely. And I think it's interesting. He and his mother had a fascinating relationship over time. And you know, somebody needs to write a really good book on that relationship, because it was loving, but at times it could also be quite interesting. There would be some stressful points, and you know, like any of us with our mothers. But So... And then he met this beautiful young widow at the end of the French Indian War, Martha Dandridge Custis, and who was the wealthiest widow in Virginia. And I think that seems to stick with people that he married her for money. And I don't think so. I think they had a wonderful, loving marriage over the course of almost 45 years. She brought with her two children into the marriage, and he served as their stepfather and then step-grandfather to children. Four grandchildren, two of whom lived with the Washingtons at Mount Vernon. Nellie and Washi then went with the Washingtons to New York and Philadelphia for the presidency. So they were sort of our first family with children. And they were relatively young during the presidency, the early years of the presidency. So it was this wonderful household. He also had a lot of nieces and nephews, and that correspondence remains. So Washington will write to his nieces and nephews. He offers advice. He guides them when he can. He helps them in any way he can. So he is a strong believer in family.
And we'll talk about Lafayette and this, that later, because they didn't have children of their own, and that'll be something that Clemens play at the end of the show. Mm-hmm. All right, let's go to Mount Vernon. So important to him, not just the home itself, but the land. He was indeed a farmer at heart, right?
He absolutely was. I used to tell people, if you were to come to a dinner party at Mount Vernon, be invited, and you were seated next to General Washington, if you wanted to have a conversation with him, then ask him about his crops or his rotation, because that is what he's most passionate about. I don't think he'd be all that inclined to discuss a battle or, you know, some disagreement in Congress. He's really going to want to discuss where his passion is, and that is his farming. And he was an extremely visionary farmer. He marries that when he becomes president with the economic future of the nation. He believes in diversification. You know, so he builds this amazingly creative and unique treading barn that's his design. He outfits his grist mill with the Oliver Evans system, which is, you know, top of line, brand new technology in the 1790s. He builds a distillery. So Washington's always looking to the future. And that's the business side of the estate. But if you look at the mansion itself, and I think this is where Washington often doesn't get credit for, but I think he shows tremendous creativity in architecture and adapting good ideas. The mansion is his conception. The piazza, which we call the first front porch in America, is Washington's conception. The rustication on the mansion, the grounds with the serpentine lanes and the bowling greens, this is all Washington's vision for this sort of world at Mount Vernon that he creates.
It's such a special place. No one's perfect. Washington certainly wasn't. Who is? Can we address some of his flaws? I mean, I often think that it's a man's flaws that we discover their real character. Don't you think so?
Absolutely. Probably when we don't want to. Washington, you know, he has a terrible temper. And I think many historians, and I've worked with a lot of historians over the years, will comment on his temper, but then will compliment and say he learned how to control that. And sort of put it to good use. He is, and you and I talked about it a while back, he's very, to put it bluntly, thin-skinned. He doesn't deal with criticism well. And until the first term of his presidency, and especially the second term, Washington didn't face that much public criticism. He is an iconic figure in the nation from, you know, 1777 on. You know, Washington is, in many ways, represents this new nation. So he wasn't used to being criticized. And he didn't always respond that well. He's open-minded. He is open to discussion and disagreement. Where you'll fall out with Washington is if he feels that you have questioned his personal integrity. So, for example, by the end of his life, he had fallen out with Thomas Jefferson. He'd fallen out with George Mason. He was close to falling out with Madison because they felt in these disagreements over the direction of the nation or policies of the nation that they somehow had impugned his honor. He didn't mind disagreement, but he felt that they had questioned his integrity. And once you did that, basically Washington, I don't know, to cut you out of your life, but the friendship was gone.
Fascinating. One last question and one quick answer, and that is, what do you think he would think of the world as it is today, our nation as it is today? I know you called him a visionary to me in our pre-interview. So as a visionary, what would you think he would think?
I think he'd be amazed on a number of points. I think that he would absolutely, you know, growing from 13 to 50 states, I don't know if he would have ever imagined that. He loved technology. He loved gadgets. So I've often wondered, what would George Washington think with all the amazing technology that we have in our country today, that he would be able to get on a plane and fly from Virginia well beyond into the Ohio country in just a couple of hours. I just think that would fascinate him, the communication systems that we're able to do. So, you know, it's hard to put yourself in the 18th century mind, but I think Washington would find that just amazing, and I think he would think that was a great advance in our nation.
You know, I really wanted the answer to a political question more than that.
I know.
But I'll settle for that. Nancy,
he would have answered that, so, all right.
He would what?
He wouldn't have answered that. So.
Yeah, probably not. Nancy Hayward, Director of Educational Outreach for Mount Vernon. She's a great, Nancy, you give a great interview. For more information on Mount, you're welcome. On Mount Vernon, visit www.mountvernon.org. And on Facebook, visit Mount Vernon for Teachers. And don't forget George Washington's 281st birthday weekend celebration, February 16th and 17th, Saturday and Sunday, 9 to 4 p.m. Hey, and on the 18th, there'll be free admission to Mount Vernon. So if you're in the neighborhood, stop by. It's a great place if you've never been there. It's life-altering. We'll post this on our website also at www.hallicaster-jane.com blog. Nancy, stick around. We may have time to bring you back at the end. I hope so. I have so much more I'd like to talk to you about. So we'll be back, hopefully, with Nancy at the end of the show. Thanks again.
Thank you, Hallie. Bye.
Susan R. Stein is the Richard Gilder Senior Curator and Vice President of Museum Programs at Monticello in Charlottesville, Virginia. For over 20 years, she has studied Thomas Jefferson and Monticello. She's produced landmark exhibitions, including last year's popular exhibition at the Smithsonian National Museum of American History called Slavery at Jefferson's Monticello, Paradox of Liberty, and welcome to the Hallicaster Jane Show, Susan R. Stein. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Callie. It's great to be here. I'm so glad you invited me. Thank you.
Oh, I'm so happy to have you here. Susan, Thomas Jefferson and Monticello, man and place. I absolutely do not think that you can talk about one without focusing on the other. They are so reflective of each other, aren't they?
Indeed they are. Sometimes people describe Monticello as Jefferson's autobiography, and I think that's true because what you see there is so reflective of what he was thinking about when he designed that amazing 5,000-acre plantation in Virginia's Piedmont. When he began constructing it in 1769, it was at the fringe of the frontier, yet he decided to erect a building that was neoclassical, that echoed what was great about the past and about Rome in particular. So he brought the power of his intellect into a physical form at Monticello.
To understand Monticello, the place, let's try and understand our third president of the United States, Mr. Jefferson. He is something of an enigma, isn't he? Let's talk about his beginnings, because I think there, too, just like with Washington, you can kind of garner the man he became from his early relationships and losses. Let's do this one quickly, because I got 1,000 questions, and I'm looking at that clock.
Sure. So Jefferson was born to parents who were gentry. They lived at a plantation called Shadwell, not far from Monticello. And Jefferson lost his father at an early age. He studied at a local school. He went to the College of William and Mary in 1760-62. There he became a student of George Wythe, one of the great legal intellects of the age. And he there learned about the Enlightenment. And it was something that powered his life for forever, because he completely adopted Enlightenment values. He believed that reason and knowledge harnessed together could improve the lives of mankind, and that became his cause.
I guess the two words, Renaissance man. I mean, if ever there was one, right?
Yeah.
Mr. Jefferson was it.
Yeah, Renaissance man in the sense of being like Leonardo, but really he was in his mind, the way that historians think about that now is that he was really a product of Enlightenment thinking. So his interests ranged through all of what was known. He was interested in astronomy, in botany, in biology, in chemistry, in everything that he saw, in music, art, science. While he was president, for example, he was head of the American Philosophical Society, the premier scientific organization in America.
And see, this fascinates me because in our generation, The only other person I liken that to would be Bill Clinton, who is both a left brain and a right brain thinker. You know, he can go. You know what I'm saying? He can go into culture just as much as he can go into politics. And in that sense, that's what always fascinated me about Jefferson. I mean, he's a writer, he's an architect, he's a scientist, a humanist. He plays chess, he plays the violin. How many languages did he speak? Like ridiculous five languages?
Fluently? Many. Romance. Well, he read all of these languages, and his library reflected the range of his knowledge. He had the largest private library in the United States, and it, Halley, became the nucleus of the Library of Congress. After the British burned the U.S. Capitol during the War of 1812, Jefferson offered his library to Congress, and they acquired it, all nearly 7,000 titles, and it became really the nucleus of that great library.
Guy, such a trip. Let's talk mentor quickly, because George White was his mentor, just as Lord Fairfax was Washington's. And I think that's important to say, because I think there's a pattern in these guys. And since we're doing this as far as looking at them as character and who they became, I think it's important to say that. He's also known as a reluctant politician. I love that, because despite his reluctance, so he winds up writing the Declaration of Independence. He becomes president. He serves as Secretary of State. He serves as Governor of Virginia. I mean, talk about reluctance. Talk to us about that.
I think that he was drawn to public service because he was utterly devoted to the country that he helped to found. And what drove him is really, I think, is his ambition, in a sense, for this country, for self-government, for the rights of man, he was the person who expressed our country's aspirations. And in every single thing that he did, he attempted to assure the future of that country, of our country. And so I see him as being very directed and very, very much inspired by not only George Wythe, but a professor at the College of William and Mary called William Small. And he was a product of the Scottish Enlightenment. And once Jefferson got hold of that, he just never let go. It was something that he pursued forever. And when he retired from the presidency, he wrote that he wrote at various times that he was better suited for the tranquil pursuit of science rather than the occupation of politics, because that was much more of a contact sport, you know.
That's exactly what it is. Susan, Monticello. And by the way, folks, if you've never been there, you must go there. It is astonishing. You can't know Jefferson, in my opinion, until you experience firsthand his genius as carved out in every brick of his world, don't you think?
I do indeed. And Monticello is now celebrating 25 years on the UNESCO World Heritage List. And it was placed there because it's recognized internationally as a product of Jefferson's creative genius. And that 5,000-acre plantation includes agricultural lands that were at first devoted to raising tobacco and later wheat, and also that amazing house that Jefferson worked on for over 40 years. And it's that neoclassical house erected in central Virginia of local brick that has drawn people from around the world during Jefferson's time and to the present.
And when you walk in there, just the way his bed is situated, and you see, you know, his gadgets all around the house and the books, and it's so him.
when you walk
into that great entrance foyer, too, I think it's breathtaking.
I'm so glad that you remember that, because that hall was his attempt at, it's like Jefferson's own Smithsonian in a way.
Absolutely,
because
right.
It has natural history specimens, it's got works of art, it's got sculpture, paintings, and the Indian Hall that he established there after the return of Lewis and Clark. And of course, he had initiated that expedition west, and they sent things to him during the expedition.
Right. To some, Jefferson was a genius, but to others, he was a contemptible hypocrite, I think was a quote that I read somewhere. And the accusation comes from the writing, the fact that he wrote the words in the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal, while at the same time being the second largest slave owner in Albemarle County in Virginia. And on the other hand, though, when he was president, he did pass a bill that banned the importation of slaves in the U.S. So I don't think we can talk about him without discussing the issue of slavery.
Well, I don't think that we can talk about the founding of our country without discussion of the issue of slavery, because if my memory is right, the first 12 presidents, including Washington, were all slaveholders.
Absolutely, sure.
So the issue of slavery is tremendously important, and it was a problem, the one problem, in a way, that the founders could not resolve. And Jefferson was not any different from other slaveholders. But we hold him, I think, to a higher standard because he wrote those incredible words in the Declaration of Independence. But I think of them, Hallie, as aspirational. Those mm-hmm. words are words that inspired Americans then and inspire people around the world today. We all know that the rights of man, that all people around the world have not yet achieved the rights that were described by Jefferson in 1776.
I think the point's well taken. You have to put people in the context of their own lives, and that's why I wanted to bring that up. We're so short on time, I would have certainly brought it up with Washington as well. He was the first foodie, Jefferson. Told you that.
Oh, yeah.
I love that, and I've only got 30 seconds to discuss that, so go for it.
He had only French-trained chefs after 1784, so for the whole remainder of life, he was eating a combination of French and Virginia cuisine, and he had a fabulous garden, and fresh vegetables of hundreds of varieties made their way to his table. And he was renowned for the table that he provided. Not only food, Hallie, but also great wine.
And really, I lived in Virginia, I think I told you that, for a long time, and wine business is making a comeback, and everybody's trying to do what Jefferson introduced. I don't know that he was all that successful at it, but it's become, the thing to do now, right?
Well, there is a burgeoning wine industry locally and throughout the Commonwealth of Virginia, and we're thrilled to see that Jefferson's dream is realized.
That's great. Now, I asked the same question before, but I'm going to ask the question before I'm going to ask it of you. What do you think that Jefferson would think of the nation as it is today?
Well, I guess I have two thoughts, and of course I agree with everything that Nancy said, that I think that Jefferson would be dazzled by the technology, by transportation, by so much that's modern, because I think that Jefferson is perhaps the most modern and contemporary of all of the founders. And I think he would have been amazed with how the lives of ordinary people had improved. I think that he would be stunned by the multicultural and multiracial society that we have, because that was beyond his imagination, I think. So I think that would be a surprise to him. And I think that he would be pleased by the success of the experiment in self-government and how it has succeeded. He perhaps would be disappointed by the sometime lack of civility in our government. He would, I think, be surprised by the lack of consensus, the lack of desire to build consensus, because that was an important part.
Interesting
part
word,
of government
surprise. I like the word surprise in that. I wish we had more time for this segment. We don't, but I want to thank Susan for being here. Susan R. Stein, not enough time, as I said. Maybe we can bring you back at the end of the show, so stick around.
Thank you
for being my guest on the Hallie-Caster Jane. And for more information, by the way, on Monticello, and really, I'm not joking when I say this is a place that you need to visit. Mount Vernon is a little bit more popular, I think, and people get there, but Monticello, oh, it's heaven. www.monticello.org. And on Facebook, go to TJ Monticello. We'll be posting more information on events and exhibitions on our website about Monticello. So visit www, again, HallieCasser-Jane.com. Again, Nancy, thanks. Thanks so much. Okay, we need to take a little break here, folks, before we go ahead. We got to talk to those people we call our sponsors. So hang in there, and we'll be back in a few.
Aging can bring about many issues for the ones we love. Is someone you love living with frequent pain? Are they spending more time just sitting in a chair or lying in bed? Are they going to the ER more often? Other than taking them to the doctor, it can be difficult figuring out what else to do. Treasure Coast Hospice can help in more ways than you may realize. Even if you don't think your loved one is ready for hospice care, Treasure Coast Hospice can answer your questions and discuss your concerns. Their team of experts can evaluate your loved one's condition and direct you to the right resources in our community who may be able to assist you. If your loved one can benefit from hospice care, you won't find a more experienced team to help them live more comfortably and support your entire family in making your time together more meaningful. You don't have to face this alone. Call Treasure Coast Hospice today to see how they can help or learn more at tchospice.org.
Hi, I'm Linda Evans, and I'm a fan of the Hallie Casser Jane Show, talk radio for fine minds.
Mark Leibson is a journalist, historian, and the author of 7 books, which I kind of muddled at the beginning of this show. Sorry, Mark. He's a former journalist for Congressional Quarterly, current arts editor, columnist, and senior writer for the Veteran Magazine, published by Vietnam Veterans of America. And today he's here to talk about the Marquis de Lafayette as the author of a wonderful book on Lafayette titled Lafayette, the Idealist General. Welcome to the Hallie Casser Jane Show, Mark Leibson.
Thanks very much for asking me to be on.
Oh, I'm happy to have you here. Okay, Mark, we got a little time. I want to get through this and maybe bring everybody back at the end. There are 44 cities and counties named for Lafayette in the U.S. He dined alone with the first 7 presidents of the U.S., the only foreigner to do so. But I'd venture to say there's still a lot of people out there who aren't all that familiar with him. So let's get a little bit of background on who he is or was. Tell us about him.
Yeah, well, you know, my book is a concise biography of Lafayette, which is hard to do for a man who lived such a long life and was so integral in 2 amazing world events, you know, our revolution and the French Revolution. So now you're asking me to tell you about him in a few minutes, so I have to talk really fast. But
go
you know,
for it. We'll keep up.
He came from a family of warriors from a backwoods area of France called Auvergne. Kind of central France, mountainous area, on his father's side. And he was brought up to be a warrior. His father died when he was 2 years old in 1759 at the Battle of Minden, killed by the British. So he grew up without a father. He was the favorite son in this. His mother's family, the Riviere family, was quite well off. And then he lived down in central France, and she brought him up to Paris. And it was the time of, you know, Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette. And he never felt at ease in that society. He wanted to be a soldier. So they sent him to military school. And, you know, then he married very well into the Noailles family, who was very up there on the aristocratic ladder. And when his Riviere grandfather and mother died, he inherited vast lands and income. He was one of the richest, if not the richest, young men in France. And, you know, he got it into his head when he was 19 years old to come over here and fight in our revolution. And he wound up buying his own ship to do so. And, came over here in 1777 and marched up to the Continental Congress in Philadelphia and said he was here to serve. And he would serve without pay, which he did for the entire revolution. In fact, not only did he serve without pay, but he, out of his own pocket, paid for uniforms for his men and food and ammunition and stuff like that. And his only requirement was that he be made a major general, which he was. So at age 19, he was a major general in the Continental Army.
And you just think about that. That's just so extraordinary. A little tidbit here. He was a member of King's Black Musketeers when he was 13, which is really the Three Musketeers. No? Is that true?
Yeah. Yeah, it was a ceremonial thing. And you know, he knew everybody at court. He knew the king. He knew the foreign minister. He knew the prime minister. So he was an extremely well-connected young man. And that would come to the fore later, because not only did he become a very good general in the revolution, but he was sent back to France, you know, in 1779 to help get more French support. And he did. I mean, he wasn't working alone. He had help from a few people that we might know, you know, Benjamin Franklin and John Adams and John Jay. But they convinced the king to send more troops and more money, and which really basically turned the tide in the revolution. You know, we could not have won that revolution without the help of the French.
You jumped ahead, but as long as we're there, let's go for it, because I do think that that is essential. I mean, first of all, not only did he prove himself to be this unbelievable, you know, soldier, warrior, but he also was a diplomat. I mean, first of all, he got the French into our revolution. Is that correct? I mean,
well,
you know,
he didn't get them in, but he was able to keep them in and increase the amount of money and troops that they sent. Yes, absolutely.
And, right. So, I mean,
and he didn't do it by himself, but he was very influential in doing that. Right.
No small. And he was what, 19, 20, 21 when he did all of that?
He was 21. I mean, he turned
20. Imagine a kid today. I mean, come on.
You can't imagine. I mean, he was a major general in the Continental Army at age 19, right?
Pretty wonderful. He actually had a sense of greatness, didn't he? He had a sense of his own destiny. I've read a lot about that. Talk to
him. Yeah,
us
he had a very high
that.
Opinion of himself, right?
Yeah.
Probably justified.
Clearly
but,
justified.
No, I mean, absolutely. And it might have been. It probably was one of the reasons that he succeeded so well. I mean, he had a lot of confidence. You know, that he had never seen any military action until the Battle of Brandywine on September 11, 1777. And you know, when he came over here, they put him on George Washington's staff as an aide-de-camp. They did not want him. They didn't want to risk him in battle because of his, you know, contacts and connections back at the French court. But when the things went badly at Brandywine, Lafayette was chafing at the bit to get into it, and Washington said, go. And from the second he saw the bullets flying, he took command, and people listened. You know, that was almost a rout, and he stemmed this rout of the Continental Army, and he led an orderly retreat.
He was wounded, too, right?
Yeah, he got shot through the calf. Still,
that would
troops,
be like
so.
Prince William going to Afghanistan and getting wounded. I mean, that's huge. When you think about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, maybe bigger.
Bigger.
Yeah.
Okay, bigger. I want to ask you about this, too. He is fearless in combat, and he had some really interesting ideas as a technician. We call him the father of guerrilla warfare. Is that fair?
Well, I mean, he wasn't maybe the father, but he was one of the better practitioners of it. He learned very, very quickly when he got over here. You know, because he had no experience, but look who he learned under, you know, George Washington. And, you know, I think it bears mentioning here that, you know, he and Washington bonded immediately, so much so that Washington considered him, you know, a surrogate son. He never had any children of his own. And Lafayette, whose father died when he was two, considered Washington, you know, all but his adopted father. And so he learned from him. He learned from von Steuben and others, and his greatest military accomplishment, the military historians say, was what happened later in the war in 1781 with everything that led up to Yorktown. He was put in charge, you know, after he proved himself at Brandywine, he was given command of troops, and he was put in charge of the Virginia operations leading up to Yorktown, and his job with vastly inferior numbers was to try to keep Cornwallis and Benedict Arnold, who was working with Cornwallis, bottled up in Virginia. And so they had many more troops. I think they had something like 6,000 or 7,000. He had like 2,000. And just as you said, he conceived of this hit-and-run guerrilla stuff where they would, in the middle of the night, they would raid the British camp and blow up their ammunition. And by the time the Redcoats came out and formed a line, Lafayette and the men had disappeared into the woods. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, I want to really spend another moment on this relationship he did have with Washington, because it's beautiful in a way. I mean, Washington didn't have any son of his own, and then Lafayette, actually, didn't he name his firstborn son George Washington Lafayette?
His only son, George Washington
yeah.
Lafayette. Yeah, absolutely.
And
he had a daughter that he named Virginie. The French word
I
for
love
Virginia,
that.
Because he liked
right.
Virginia so much.
I don't blame him. But that relationship that they had really was quite special, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And you can read the letters that went back and forth. And Lafayette was devoted to Washington until the day that Washington died. And, you know, he came back here once after the Revolution, had this very emotional reunion with Washington at Mount Vernon, and he came back after and, of course, paid a visit to his grave at Mount Vernon. But the letters are just – they do read like father and son letters, absolutely.
I love that. Let's go to that last scene, because he did come back. He spent 10 days, I guess, with Washington at Mount Vernon, right? Am I right?
I'm not quite certain how long it was, but it was a good amount of time, yeah.
Yeah, and when I read that part, my heart just kind of leapt, because you can envision Washington watching him leave, knowing he's never going to see him again.
Right.
I mean, you know,
well, you
somebody
know, there
that
was also,
tight with.
I was going to say, in the context of this program today, you know, he had this famous final return trip to the United States in 1824, 1825. He was also a very close friend of Thomas Jefferson's.
Right.
And they had this amazingly emotional reunion. They both knew, you know, by that time, Jefferson was in his 80s and Lafayette was in his 70s. They knew it was going to be the last time they saw each other. And he came up to the mountain with his entourage, and, you know, everybody was in a big circle out in front of the front door. And Jefferson came out. Lafayette got out of his coach. They embraced. Jefferson wept. I mean, it was the first time people had ever seen Jefferson weep in public, and it was that was a truly also another really sort of amazing moment in American history. Sure.
Why did you choose to write about Lafayette?
Well, I mean, do you want to know the real truth?
Well,
yes, you do. I was looking for. Well, actually, you know,
no, lie to me.
No, I won't lie to you. I had written this book called Saving Monticello, you know, which is a history of Thomas Jefferson's house, but focusing on what happened after he died. By the way, Susan Stein was extremely helpful to me in writing that book, and I'm forever grateful to her. And, you know, I talked about that scene with Lafayette and Jefferson. So when I had finished my previous book, my agent and I were searching around for a topic, and I don't know how it came up, but Lafayette came up, and I said, you know, I've always wanted to write about him, and I got a contract to write the book. So it's part of a series of books called the World General Series, and so that's why it's a concise bio. I mean, there probably been 50 biographies of Lafayette, but this is the first concise biography of him.
I was so glad, you know, when you and I talked about doing this, because I've always been enamored of him, and I don't understand why he doesn't. Maybe because he wasn't American is the only reason that I could think that he didn't rise to the grandeur, because he really was quite extraordinary, and I don't think we could have won the war without him.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we couldn't have won the war without the French, and there wasn't anyone who did more than help get the French. You know, if you count sailors and Marines, there were more French troops at Yorktown than there were American troops. And
is that true? I didn't
definitely.
Know that.
Yes, if you count sailors and Marines. That doesn't count the Frenchmen who were in the Continental Army, such as Lafayette. And, you know, he, you know, was a good general. Not you know, he was not on the caliber of Nathaniel Greene or George Washington, but he was one of our better generals. But no general was, you know, went back to France and helped turn the tide of that war. So, you know, you can make a very good case that he was one of the most pivotal people in us winning that revolution. Absolutely.
Absolutely is true. I'm going to bring our other guests back with us, but before I do, I just want to say that Mark Leibson, author of Lafayette, the Idealist General, visit Mark's website at www.mark.leibson.com and look for his next book due out July 4th, 2014, the biography of Francis Scott Key. But let's bring the other two ladies back, you guys. I'm Mike and Ian now, and let's go a little bit further with this, because three extraordinary men, great leaders. Tell me, do we make them like this anymore, Nancy?
I don't think so. I don't know if that we make them like this anymore, or the political landscape and just our nation today doesn't allow men to exceed and grow the way that our leaders did in the founding era.
Susan, what do we learn from all of this? When we take three iconic figures like this and when we put them out there, what can we garner from them for modern day lives and for our lives? What do you think when you give your talks? What do you
say?
That's
a great question. And, Hallie, I want to praise you for taking on this wonderful this wonderful show. I think it's just so interesting, and I'm glad that you've done it and that you have an audience.
Thank you.
It's great. It's really great. What I think we all have to gain, would be two things. Number one, inspiration from these people who did so much and who devoted themselves to their country in the ways that they did and were able to affect their time. The second thing that I think we could draw from them is the way that they tackled problems. It isn't just that they were iconic people with high ideals. They actually got out there and did things. And that is great. And I think that our country still has millions of people who echo these great men. And it may be that our political leaders don't always achieve this greatness, but many individual people do in the way that they impact the lives of ordinary people. And I think that if the founders were here, they would be very proud of that.
I haven't been in a school in a long time, but when I was in school, and I don't want to tell you how old I am, but there was always a picture somewhere in your school of Washington or Jefferson, even Lafayette in one of my history classrooms. Is that the same today? Do kids today get the same sense of patriotism and knowledge of the spirit of our founding fathers that we did when we were all kids?
Oh, Nancy and I could deliver a discourse on this.
Yes.
Sure.
Talk to me, Nancy. Talk to me, Susan. And Mark, feel free to jump in.
I think we could all say no, I'm saying no. And Mark and Susan can feel free to jump in on that one. As a matter of fact, we started the program 5 years ago where we put portraits back in the schools of George Washington. And, you know, all the principal has to do is just write Mount Vernon and ask for it, and it's a framed canvas portrait, and it's free. And that came about because our board was concerned exactly that when they grew up, even when I grew up in my elementary schools, Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington were still in our classrooms, and, you know, they stood for something. And this concept is, this is where we're teaching our future leaders about our nation, about how we came to be. And if we don't have any sort of tactile or visual or even anecdotal issues about the founding period and the men that made this great, we're losing history every day. So.
Well, we're also trying to really have a big impact on children and students today. We've got, as I'm sure Mount Vernon does, terrific resources on our website, that are directed toward teachers and students. And we're developing a new website that I'm going to plug in advance that's called Liberty Today. And it's about bringing the struggle for liberty to students all over the U.S. So we're piloting that now. We're sort of in a beta version internally, but hope to launch that before too long. So I think that we need to communicate with the means that reach students too. And
I love
we know
that.
We know that the internet is it, and we've got to combat historical ignorance, all of us.
Yeah, Mark, I want to throw something at it. Let's throw something at it, Mark, for a second, because this just crossed my mind, and that's this. International standing. which has taken a hit from the United States over the last years, and you know, maybe it's coming back, maybe it's not. But when you take a figure like Lafayette and you give him his due for what he did for this nation, I think it's powerful stuff that on an international scale can mean so much to who this country is in the larger realm of a borderless world that we somewhat live in. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, it's hard for me to put that into 21st century terms, but, you know, it's definitely true. And, you know, we didn't even talk about, he played a very important role in the French Revolution, you know. He was basically the military governor of Paris as things were just going crazy, and he kept things on an even, well, not an even keel, but he probably saved the life of the king twice before. And, you know, but just one other point about him is that, you know, the subtitle of the book is The Idealist General. You know, this is a man who stuck to his ideals. I mean, he was a constitutional monarchist. He stood for, he didn't want, you know, to overthrow the king, but he did, but he wanted to have the same freedoms that he fought for in this country, in France, and it got him into an awful lot of trouble. And then he also played an important role in this little known but fairly important event called the July Revolution of 1830 in France, which could have gone really badly. I mean, people went to the barricades. Lafayette was the most popular politician in France, and he basically put an end to it by bringing in Louis Philippe, you know, the famous the citizen king who didn't have all the trappings of royalty. So the man played a huge role in two of, you know, in two countries, and you know, I don't know how that translates into 21st century. I don't know. You know, you asked earlier, you know, what lessons for children. It's hard to say in the 21st century, but this was a man, if you just look at what he did in his life, you know, very few people have played such an important role in so many, you know, important, you know, political changing issues.
And on such an international stage, I think that that's what we're talking about here. Was it, Nancy, were you going to try and say something before I so rudely interrupted you?
No, not at all. No, I was interrupting. I was agreeing with Susan and you as well in that I think all of the messages that we send to children and into classrooms across the country, we like Monticello are adjusting those to deliver them in ways that engage students today. So web sources, tweeting, which, you know, I'm no longer sure is the end of civilization, but it's a close thing for me. But if we want children to get a message and get engaged in the story, then we have to do it on their terms. And there are great ways to do that, as Monticello is doing with their new website and some of the sources that we're doing. So I think that's exciting as we look forward to teaching more about our founding era and this great generation.
Two words keep popping into my head. One is three words, Renaissance man, those are two words, and the other one is idealist. Those are lost in our culture today. I don't know that people aspire to be Renaissance men or women in the terms of which, you know, you guys can probably figure out how I'm seeing it. And idealism is something that comes rarely. You see it in Nelson Mandela, in a Martin Luther King, maybe. But it's not something that is innate to our natures, to the way I think it was back then. And that, I think, again, has to go with education. I guess I'm picking on the educational system right now, aren't I? And I am, because I think it's a problem. Any thoughts from you guys?
Well, I could throw it back at you and suggest the media might have something to do with that as well. But that's
by all means.
You know, do we believe there's a true visionary or idealist that doesn't have flaws that we would go and pick at? I think that although the press, I think people would be surprised to learn how ugly the press could be in the late 18th century, I don't think any one of those gentlemen would have imagined the press of today. So I do think we don't teach enough. But I also wonder if the media plays a role in that, Hallie.
I agree with Nancy on that, too, because Lafayette certainly had his flaws. But, you know, if you study him, you won't read too much about them. They're sort of in between the lines. But sort of history becomes, you know, Lafayette's greatest hits and Washington's greatest hits and Jefferson's greatest hits.
I think we're all of an age when, before JFK, that there were certain rules that the press stuck to when it came to handling our revered leaders that aren't stuck to today. Could we be discussing that? Is that, in a sense, what are the problems? Because we tear our leaders down on such a base level, on such an innocuous level.
Well, I think that the tough time that James Callender gave Jefferson in the press for his relationship with Sally Hemings
right.
is certainly no harder than what exists today. But to get back to your earlier question, I think that we adults are accustomed to a very cynical, critical press, which was equally true in the 18th century. But I think somewhere in the teaching of history, it's actually a very exciting thing to study if you think about history as a struggle, as something where you don't really know what the outcome is going to be. And it might have been that when we studied history way back when, that it was presented as something more iconic and less deep. And now we live in a time where we can really ask the important questions and get discussion and conversation going, because it's really all about understanding through dialogue, digging into something deeply to understand it, not to judge it, but to understand it.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to end on that. I'm looking at the clock. I'm so involved in this show that I forgot to look at my clock. You guys have been great. Thanks, Mark. Thanks, Nancy.
Pleasure.
Thanks, Susan. This has really, really been great. I hope one day we'll get you guys back, and I hope you'll all go visit Mount Vernon, go to Monticello, and pick up Mark Leibson's book, Lafayette the Idealist General. So thanks again, guys. Great to have you here. Before I go, I want to remind everybody that our podcasts of current and past shows are available free on iTunes under The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. You can also listen to us on the mobile site, mblogtalkradio.com, and on HallieKasserJane.com. Please do. Of course, we'll be back next week for another edition of the Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, Talk Radio for Fine Minds, brought to you by Treasure Coast Hospice at tchospice.org. Stay in touch, won't you? You can visit me at HallieKasserJane.com, on Facebook at Hallie Kasser-Jane, and on that thing we were just calling about, Twitter, where my handle is Hallie CJ. I actually love to hear from you. We'll put the information on all of our three guests and what they're representing on the website, by the way. I'll say that again. So until we meet again, this is Hallie Kasser-Jane. Thanks again to my great guests. It's a wrap.
You have been listening to The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, talk radio for fine minds. The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show airs Wednesdays at 3 p.m. and Thursdays at 9 p.m. Eastern on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Thank you for listening to The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show.